I am Jerry Barney, and we're having a session today entitled Loony Ideas About How to Save the Creation. And Jane Blewett was supposed to have helped me, but she feels that she's given all most of her loony ideas, so she may add a little at the end. And I hope some others have got some loony ideas too, because I'm not sure I've got an adequate amount.
You thought you were a real loony.
Yes. Well, I guess my maybe a place to start with the loony ideas is well, I think a lot of our trouble in kind of being able to perceive and willing to see and hear what's happening has to do with, well, the first few passages of Genesis 2 concerning the eighth day of creation, because it's there that we get the idea that the creation is finished. But on that eighth day, God said, the earth is now created, it's finished. And that makes it difficult for us to accept the kind of new cosmology that Jane and Tom Berry and Matthew Fox and lots of others are talking about. And if we have difficulty accepting that, we have difficulty seeing the trees as cousins and deer as cousins, and expanding our sense of neighbor. And so I think that eighth day of creation is a pretty important part of where we come into this all. And the very literal interpretation of that, I think, is inspired by the passage that says that all Scripture is given by inspiration of God. And as we were talking after the last session, in effect, that means when you take that literally, that all translations, all interpretations, the Council of Nicaea, and everything else that has gone up to produce the Bible in its current form, are all done by or come about by inspiration of God. A loony idea here might be that we could come to a somewhat different understanding of what Scripture is, and in particular what Genesis is. My sense of what the way Genesis came about is that somebody, we don't even know who, went to sleep one night and had a dream. And we'd say that God gave them a vision. And this was a person who lived at a time when there was no understanding of how weather worked, there was no understanding of geology, there was no understanding of the origin of babies, sex, there was virtually no scientific understanding. And I can kind of envision this as being a dream or a vision in which God appears to this person, this poor, unfortunate person, I would say, in a way, said, "Okay, I'm going to tell you how I did it." And then we saw here this videotape on the origins of the universe. And I think that's basically what the dream was. But maybe put in order in the way in which God did it.
No PCRs at that time.
What's that?
No PCRs at that time.
No, but a VCR and a dream. Where, to start with, this person sees, on a scale that's not even really clear, but sees the original particle, from which everything emerged, created something tinier, far more energetic than we have any way of even really envisioning at the moment, but a single particle. And that decaying in 10 to the minus 70th seconds into a whole host of other things. Probably God showed it to him on a logarithmic scale so that he could really get some appreciation for what all the steps were. But without any understanding that there were such things as what we call elementary particles, you know, this stuff all goes on, and finally these clouds of neutrons and quasars begin to emerge, and it's void and formless, and eventually, you know, after most of the dream is over, the Earth appears, and water begins to appear, and finally, as Jane was talking, it's only in the last half hour, when you think of a 365-day year, that the human appears on the scene. I can imagine this person seeing all of that, and then that kind of brings it up to date, and I doubt that God showed anything about the future. And at the end of the dream, you kind of turn things off, and then God says, okay, now when you wake up, I want you to go write that down. And out of that comes an account like we have in the first account of creation. And I think we've seen quite a bit of evidence that either other people had visions and other accounts were written, or that different people who were maintaining the oral tradition or the written tradition kind of doctored it up, and so we've got more than one account of how it all came about. But in that way, I can feel quite comfortable with saying that all scriptures is given by inspiration of God, but also feel quite comfortable with saying that you have to interpret the account of creation with a great deal of charity for the poor person who got the task of writing it all down after having seen this vision of how it all took place. And I think that you can understand that vision kind of coming up to the time that the person was living. And looking at it in that way, one would certainly get the sense that God had rested, and that the creation had was finished in some sense. But given that as an interpretation, which I'm afraid a lot of members of or people who call themselves Christian would have a lot of trouble with. That's not really a very comfortable interpretation, particularly for fundamentalists. But that would open up a lot of possibilities. And I, you know, the next thing that I think is would be important for me is to come to a better understanding of what our job is here as humans. And I really see that as we were talking about a little earlier, as trying to restore the creation to what it was before the fall. And in some ways, I suppose Lutheranism and mainline Christianity would say, well, that's what we've been working on all along. But if that's the case, I think we have to say that there's some aspects of society that really need some fundamental reexamination. We we've tried for too long to get our sense of security out of weapons. And I don't find the church really questioning that very fundamentally. We talk about the doctrine of a just war, you know, when really pressed into what does the church have to say about war. Well, wheel that thing out. But I'm not even sure that's a very useful place to start. It seems to me it would be a lot more useful to begin asking questions about what is a God-pleasing war? You know, when, if ever, would God be pleased by war? Just war? Well, you know, I find that concept even really very lacking. But even if you were going to take the just war idea, there are questions in my mind anyway about why is it as an institution that the concept of a just war is never ever discussed with kids before they make the vocatio decision about joining the military. That's never ever discussed. It's been discussed with the young people in my church because I went to the youth director and said, I want to talk to him about this. And there were parents who objected, so there was a retired two-star general that went with me to discuss it. And a really astonishing thing occurred then when we discovered that session with those young people was the first time that general had ever thought about the killing that he did and its relation to the Fifth Commandment. Never, ever before had he talked about it. I remember being shocked when one of the senior most Lutheran, what do we call these pastors who work in the military? Chaplains. Yeah. Was at our church and we were talking with him about his work. And he kind of explained it all, and at the end I asked him if he had ever gone and talked with the senior military, who's a Navy chaplain, had ever talked with the top admirals about whether or not the Vietnam War was a just war. And he kind of went slack-jawed and said, would you think that would be the job of a chaplain? I just feel that this whole area of violence or the threat of violence as being a satisfactory means of trying to achieve security is something that at least the institution of the church has accepted all the way along for a long, long time and has never really raised any question about it. It's a divisive matter, and if you take the idea that the most important thing is to get another soul into heaven and you don't want to drive anybody out of the church, then maybe that's an explanation as to why people are afraid to raise it. But in my experience, the clergy are afraid to talk about that. They really are. They're also afraid to talk about vocation in this sense. Should you be in the CIA? Should you be in the Defense Intelligence Agency? Is that a Christian vocation? Should you be in an institution that is deliberately and regularly exaggerating the threat to the nation as a means of justifying bigger budgets for the military and bigger budgets for the defense contractors? Now, is that a reasonable Christian calling? Should you be in the business of developing nuclear weapons? Some of you know that perhaps the most terrifying experience of my life was one Monday morning to walk in and start a course, a 1-week course at Sandia National Laboratories. in New Mexico, which I was to talk for a week about what's happening to the planet and the real fundamental aspects of national security for the United States. And the whole audience were people who were involved in building nuclear weapons. And my explicit agenda during that week was to try to get them to look seriously at the purpose of Sandia National Laboratories, which is to use science and technology to support the national security of the nation, and to have them come away from that 1 week of talking about what really is going on in the world, and to come to a sense that they needed to do something much, much different than what they were doing if they were going to be true to their purpose, that nuclear weapons were in fact increasing the insecurity of our nation. That's the kind of probing examination that I think that somehow the institution of the church needs to be engaged in. But as I look at the people who make up the institution, and as I look at the young people in my own congregation and others that are considering going into the institution, I have to say we're not getting the top brains. You know, the top 10% of the SAT scores, those people are not going into the clergy, they're not going into the church. And that's a tragedy in itself. We need some really capable people that go in there. And in part, I think that the reason that you don't get people like that going in is that they don't feel that that's where the real excitement is today. That the excitement is somewhere else. And in a way, I have to agree with them, because the institution is, in my expectation, afraid to deal with the really important issues of the day. And until such time as it becomes an exciting place, I don't think any bright young person is going to want to, that's not the place they're going to choose to go. They want to go to some place where there is some excitement. And the church isn't it, as best I can see. But even if that's not the case, the training that religious leaders get is so narrowly focused on the book that they have trouble understanding and relating to the range of issues that that need to be discussed today. They don't understand them. My own pastor, and I respect him dearly for this, says that he feels an outsider. That when he goes and visits, and this is something that I do commend him for, he goes and visits his parishioners and in their jobs. But he says, I feel an outsider there. I don't know what's going on. I don't understand what they do. And somehow there needs to be a way found, I think, to broaden the range of things that people are exposed to when they go to a seminary. And in particular, I like the idea that got, a number of people have suggested it here, the idea that we need to learn to hear the earth. And to my understanding, that means that somehow we've got to bring science and religion together, if Jane's right, we have to learn this new cosmology. You're going to have to learn a few of the skills of science, just even to understand what the cosmology is about. We talk about interrelatedness, but until such times you know a little bit about the science of ecology, understanding relatedness in any very profound way is not going to be easy. I've talked with Rick about the possibility of getting an Apple Macintosh here with the Stella program to simulate various aspects of the ecology here, where you really see in the simulation the way in which things are interrelated. And the reason that I think that's important is that the real science of interrelatedness is something that is only described by a mathematical technique called differential equations. And only a very small part of the our population has studied enough mathematics that they've even heard the term differential equations. I mean, it's a kind of a second level of calculus. But with computer simulations, you can provide people with all of the kind of descriptive power that differential equations provide without ever even talking about calculus. It's a very intuitive kind of thing that you can do. And particularly on the Macintosh, where there's the graphics capabilities built into it, it's really a very effective teaching tool. And that combined with kind of taking people out and showing them where it's happening, how it happens, would be very effective. But all of that's to say that I think there needs to be a change, a really kind of pronounced change in the way in which seminary education is done. And coupled with that, a willingness on the part of the clergy to use the lay people more effectively, many lay people feel rather frustrated because the church has never got any role for them in which they can use their professional capabilities. In my own congregation, we have the president of the Chronobiology Society there. Now, there's a lot of cyclical things having to do with time that influence biology. You know, the president of the World Society having to study the effects of time in biology is a member of our congregation. We've got the person responsible for all the food and testing all the food additives for their safety is a member of our congregation. One of the rising stars in the whole business of tax law is in our congregation. A woman who's just furious about the inequities in the tax system. Never ever has the church ever talked with her about what really goes on. Never ever has there been any opportunity for her to use her professional expertise. Physicians, I could go on and on. There's a lot of real powerful talent. Now at one point, I'm going to forget her name. Dorothy, the woman who kind of helped bring the merger together, was kind of the head of the kind of merger committee.
Dorothy Marple.
Yes. I sat down with her and showed her a laity resource database that I designed. You know, a nice questionnaire form, several pages to get languages people knew and the skills they had. And wouldn't the new church be interested in knowing what the talents were in the laity and using them? And she took me aside at lunch and said, Jerry, you have to understand the bishops don't want that kind of information. They don't appoint people to commissions or committees or anything else unless they know them personally. The principal thing they're concerned with is getting people into these jobs who will not cause trouble. And they don't care, really, whether they have any solid professional capabilities or not. The key thing is, are they going to cause trouble? Now, I'll tell you, I nearly went faint at that. You know, that strikes me as an appalling indictment. Now, that's only one person, but that was a person that was in a key position and worked there for a long time. And she was not saying it in any malicious sort of way, but saying, don't waste your time on that. The bishops don't want to know that. They won't ever use it. Somehow, I think that if the church is going to be effective in the future, it's got to change in that regard. There's got to be enough courage, enough openness, enough willingness to do what Martin Luther did, to ask questions. That it's possible to put people in because they have the knowledge to ask the questions and not be afraid of the boat getting rocked a little bit. You know, if God is with us, who can be against us? And how can we be afraid of truth? I don't understand that. Well, you know, kind of going on a little bit here, another kind of wild idea or place that I get some wild ideas has to do with thinking about what it might have been like before the fall, and therefore what it is that we're trying to move toward. And the thing that that I find helpful in this regard is to look at the account in Genesis of what people noticed had changed as soon as the fall came about. The first thing they noticed had to do with sex. You know, they were naked. And kind of the second thing, and this is something that that God brought up, was death. It seems to me that the human species, you know, and this is what Jane keeps talking about, we need to understand ourselves as a species and how we relate to the other species. Biologists for a long time have been struggling with trying to figure out how the human species is different from the rest, and we thought for a while we were the only tool users, and that's not the case. It seems to me that in a way the human species is the only one that fears death. Now, I don't think the deer fear death. I think they avoid it instinctively, but I don't think they dwell on it all the time. I don't think they fear death, not the way we do. We fear it. And I think somehow gradually what we have to be able to get to is a willingness to try, a willingness simply not to avoid death the way we do now. One of the ways in which the two principal ways, I'd say, in which we damage drastically the whole creation by our fear of death. And one is the extraordinary amount of money that we spend on trying to stay alive another week, you know, near the end. Our medical technology has made it possible for us to stay alive longer and enjoy it less. And that's really what it's done, and at tremendous expense. But we're uncomfortable. We really are uncomfortable with those decisions. And primitive peoples, and one that I admire a great deal is stories I've read about the Eskimos older people who come to the understanding that now is the time for me to die, and will simply go walking off across the tundra until they die. Or the American Indians who would come to a day and say, this is a good day to die. And maybe it would be in battle, but they come to an understanding that this is the time when we're uncomfortable with that, and as a result, we are prey to people, corporations, technologies that will keep us alive a little bit longer and at tremendous expense. The other place is really having to do with military technology. This is a real fallacy, I would say, in the idea that Americans are prepared to die for their country. And what Americans are prepared to do is to kill for their country. Where would you find a group of Americans would say, I think it is important to be willing to die for my country, and I will be a part of a group of people who will be at service to the president, and if and when the president arrives at a position in which he feels it is critically important that someone die for their country, I and these colleagues that I have with me will go stand in front of the tanks. Unarmed, I am willing to die for my country in this way. You know, there's this whole kind of nonviolent approach to national security. That could be explored, but it's not something that church wants to get into. It's threatening. But I think that whole business about fear of death is something that, if we're going to really take seriously this whole business, we've got to get back to. And then, come back to the other one, the sex, the fear of death and our preoccupation with sex. Now, in my experience anyway, in congregations, the only commandment that people are really concerned with is the ones having to do with sex. Now, that anything else, you know, you can live your whole life in a way in which you never ever ask the question, what does God want me to do with my life? What does God want me to do today? That is not seen as serious as the least little sex-related sin. Sex is such a preoccupation with Christians that it's a carry-on of the shocking experience after the fall of Adam and Eve discovering they were naked. You know, that was a big deal. Somehow I think we've got to find ways of kind of relaxing and being somewhat more comfortable with the gift of sexuality that God has given us. And here I want to kind of wrap up what I have to say by telling you a little bit about a culture which is rapidly disappearing, which is the closest thing I know of to one in which people have figured out how to live with the creation in a sustainable way. It's the culture that exists in a little tiny, what used to be a kingdom called Ladakh, up in, you know, the northern part of India is kind of like the top of a roof. Ladakh is up right near the top of it there. It's up into the Himalayas, and it's actually across the continental divide, and it's in the part that's sloping down into China. It's a fascinating place in that it's an alpine desert. It's a high altitude desert. The rain clouds come in from the south, and the mountains and the cold kind of take the water vapor out of the air before it reaches as far north as where Ladakh is. So as you fly in from New Delhi, you come across these green, steamy plains where lots of food is being grown, and very suddenly you come to these foothills, and they're green for a while, and they start getting less green, and then the snow and ice starts, and it really gets, it's very, lots of snow, even in the summertime. K2 and Everest are right near there. But as you go a little bit further, the ground keeps getting closer to the airplane, but there's less and less snow, and by the time you get to Ladakh, there's very, very little snow. It's kind of sandy ground. Well, this is an area that's Buddhist, and the people have lived there in with a stable population. The population has not grown, and they've got on through high altitude agriculture for roughly 3,000 years. The society has been stable. And techniques have been developed. They grow primarily, the principal crop is barley. It's a high altitude barley. The low places, the bottoms of the valley in Ladakh, are about 12,000 feet. And it goes up from there. I've become acquainted with it through the Ladakh Ecological Development Center that Helena Norberg Hodge started. She's, I think she has a British passport, but her family is all over Europe. and she's, you know, genetically, I'd say she's more Swedish than anything else. She has long blonde hair, and it very fair skinned, and she went there originally with a film crew after they, shortly after the place was opened to visitors from the West, and which was about 12, 15 years ago, something like that, and went there as a linguist to try to learn a little of the language to help the film crew. And they were there for about 3 months, and by the time the time was up, she decided she was going to stay, that she just liked the place so much that she would stay. And she has spent most of her life working in Ladakh, trying to help the Ladakhis see what is happening as Western industrialized culture moves in, particularly through the army, which has moved in force now because China took a little bit of Ladakh, and the Indians weren't looking, and now the Indians are very worried about Chinese encroachments. But I went there for a conference a few years ago, and just really had trouble understanding how a place like that could get on so long in such a stable way. They have to irrigate their, any place they grow anything, they have to irrigate it, and the growing season is very, very short. And how are they managing to do this? And it's an interesting story that in many ways has to do with a different attitude toward toward sex. The first of all, the women in Ladakh have most of the wealth. The wealth is primarily in the form of jewelry and very elaborate kind of festival clothing. And a person marries in Ladakh. There's another form of the wealth too, and that's the land. And the women control the land as well. And the land is not divided up. One of the real tragedies of developing countries is when the land keeps getting divided up into smaller and smaller pieces that are not big enough to support a family. But there, the land is not divided up, and it's the oldest daughter, really, that inherits the land. And a woman marries, or a man marries, really is perhaps the way to look at it, only when he has found a woman who has land that's adequate to support them. And there are many women who don't have land that could support family. And men and women who don't marry go off to live in Buddhist monasteries, which is a very honored kind of lifestyle. So a part of keeping the population under control is that many people don't marry, and they go off and live a life in a religious community. The family continues to support them when they live there. But perhaps the most kind of striking aspect of it is that women who have a piece of land and have wealth can take multiple husbands. And an aspect of this is really important for limiting a population is that a woman can only have so many children. How many husbands they have. But if it's the other way around, where husbands have many wives, there are many more children that can be produced in that situation. But overall, I'd say that the Ladakhi attitude toward marriage arrangements is far more flexible than anything we have any idea about. And that what what seems to be more the determining factor as to how people decide to join in a marriage relationship has to do with, would it be good for the community? Would it be good for the family? Yeah, that kind of thing. Often when if a man dies, a brother will take on, will become the husband of the woman who was left as a widow. So it's a very, very different kind of attitude toward sex, toward the institution of marriage than we find here, and it's led to a society in which, even in that very, very harsh environment there, people can support themselves and be really free from any danger of starvation or hunger. An extremely harsh environment, and still have 6 months of the year in which they basically can party. That they have the skills to win from the earth what they need to live in 6 months of the year, and have 6 months of the year in which they play music and dance and basically party. Now that is such a contrast to the way in which we struggle here to make ends meet, and still have huge parts of our population that are suffering in poverty and with no real self-respect. So I guess out of all of the wild dreaming that I do, I think that somehow we have to get some very different ideas about both sex and about death as a way of moving into a different relationship with the earth. Do you want to add anything to that, Jane?
Just one point, Jerry. When I, in your, you know, just in this last part, one thing that I sense right away, we often think of Muslims as the people who have one man with several wives, and that's very hard for us to understand. And I was talking to a Muslim one day, and I was trying to ask him about this, you know, and in their religious tenets, no man should take a wife unless he can support her. It isn't just random, you're going to have any amount of wives you want at all. There's a tenet about that, and understanding. And finally he said to me, well, he said, you know, is it so different to have for a man to have three wives at one time, or three in a row, as they do in your country? And that has stayed with me for a long time. And I just want to put that in the kitty to kind of, you know, dispel, I think, a little bit of our prejudice or our sense that that's an irresponsible way of relating and to serving that country. Secondly, I would say, Jerry, that in fact, if you put as your ideal something of what that community lives, I would think you would say that the one thing that the human species brings is not to fear death, but to celebrate life. We are the only ones who can celebrate life. And I would much rather see you say that to people than that we are the ones who fear death. And make us face that. Is that really true? That we as species are the one species they can self-consciously reflect on this wonder and celebrate. I say that's our deepest meaning in the whole community. And I almost, you know, I think that forces us more in the direction of alternatively thinking.
I think otters enjoy life more than we do.
Yeah. There's no doubt about it. However, I mean, again, there is something very, very special and unique about the human species, and we are, that has to be, that's where our challenge is. I love the thing about dreaming. You know, I often, that whole thing that in many of the native people's tribes, the first activity of the morning was to gather and share their dreams. Because they had a deep sense that in the dream they saw the vision. They had a sense of the way to go. Put them in touch with something deep within. And I feel like we have to dream the kind of world, the kind of earth that you could, that can really be any kind of nightmare now. So when you know, this was supposed to be the loony session, and something of, like, when people say to me, what about Monday morning? The first thing I say is, if you do believe in some way that we are alienated from the reality of, from our reality, that we are alienated from who we are in this community of life, then what do you do when you have broken a you have to spend time. You have to invest time in reestablishing a relationship. And that's what nobody, no American wants to hear. That there's just no way we can jump, I don't think, from what's the problem today to the solution, unless we work our way through some kind of reestablishing of the relationship that we have broken.
Relationship with?
With the Earth community. With the Earth community that you are a part of now. We have broken away from any kind of knowing that we belong to something larger than ourselves, other than other humans. And I say you gotta sit and put your butt against that tree and sit there. Sit there for a while. Or whatever. Explore that tree, explore the flowers, explore the birds. Explore it until the earth gives us some kind of indication. And that's, nobody wants to hear that. I mean, or at least I shouldn't say nobody wants to hear it, but it's not a very satisfying answer for practical Americans. Now, that certainly gets accompanied with other kinds of actions. And you keep pressing, Al, what are those other actions? And I respect that, and they're certainly good. But I think those actions are, again, within the larger context, are the only ones that are going to make sense. So I say read people like Lewis Thomas, Lauren Isley, authors who open to us something of the revelation of who this community is. In this little book, this first one of Lauren Isley, The Immense Journey, he has a chapter in here called, he's a paleontologist who just reflects on his experience of discovering the earth, discovering the earth. He has a chapter in here called How Flowers Change the World. And he just describes in very simple language how at one point the earth was covered with green, all over earth. And then he uses the expression explosion of flowers, explosion. And what we understand is that in the concentrated energy in the seed of the flower, and that means the grains, that concentrated energy made it possible for mammals to evolve. Because there was energy concentrated in a form that could open up to the next development of life. Well, we have all these little bands around here. Don't forget to smell the flower. You know, I say we should kneel in front of those flowers. If it were not for that life energy from those flowers, we wouldn't be here today. And it's that way of knowing that comes to us through people who are revealing something of this mystery, this life that is all around us. So my loony idea is you have to spend time with the earth. You have to put our butts there and just be. And one other little book I just draw to your attention is an effort of this, the Hope for the Seeds. I just got it from a missionary returning from the Philippines. And the Philippine bishops have written a pastoral letter to their people under the title of What is Happening to Our Beautiful Land, Earth, or whatever the title is right here. What is Happening to Our Beautiful Land, a pastoral letter on ecology, January 1988. And this is a, he calls it a comic book edition. It isn't comic book, it's pictorial for people who do not read. In a society, in a language, in a country that are, you know, 80% are illiterate. And he goes through, and it builds on the myths of the people. What they have believed is their own story of their origins. And it is just, you know, it's just a marvelous tool.
How do we get...
Well, Dan has taken the information for the bookstore about this,
oh,
if you want to get a copy. But I use it more as just kind of the modeling in terms of, you know, I don't know, just helping us sort of take the wisdom that we have, but try to translate, if we can, in ways that are meaningful to people who know the earth, or know the sea, or know.
We might find that our left brain is working a little too hard when we say that the other creatures don't experience death or can't celebrate life.
Right.
I had a wonderful Irish setter who celebrated every day of her life while she was healthy, and just in her being, I've never seen a creature like her. She could jump through the marshes and her ears would fly, and she was just never seen a creature so in rhythm with life before. And then when she got heartworm, I saw the brightness go right out of her eyes, and she dealt with death in a way that she could, and certainly not in a cognitive way, but it was there. There's no question in my mind. And I think maybe we need to, I'd like to challenge that a little bit, and turn our right brain on a little bit.
Yeah. Well, we had a minority report going on here while you were saying that.
Right.
I've experienced the same thing. Two dogs I can think of watching experience. One, the fear of death, a very sudden thing, and seeing it in him. And another dog that I had to nurse through injuries. And that dog lying there as I ministered to him and did things that I never thought I could do. But he experienced great pain, and yet he would lie there patiently, and I never had to muzzle him and put up and let me do that, and always looking at me with love while I did it. You know, that is well beyond you know, what we attributed to that.
I would, along with that, I challenge some of Bolden's notions on, in terms of all creatures, notion of vegetarianism. I mean, you know, have we developed an idea that animals are on such a higher level that it's more wrong to eat an animal than a plant? I mean, really think about it. With what you've just said about flowers, I don't know about that. I think there's a way that we, you know, in eating, very important statement to be made about consumption and eating, where we eat on the food chain. I think that's extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some other points to be made with that too.
So,
I mean, these are some of the implications that I draw from it.
Right.
So, and I think Holden needs to be challenged in some ways too.
Carol had her hand up.
Well, it's a different subject. I wanted to pick up on some of your earlier comments, and I think I came in the middle of them, so just about clergy, I heard you talking about theologically trained people, I guess I heard it specifically as clergy, and that our best and brightest aren't becoming clergy, and that the church just isn't where the exciting issues are. The church is like the exciting place. I agree that there's a lot of mediocrity in the clergy. But every time I found myself saying those things and commenting on that, and saying that that's part of what's wrong with the church, I feel like I'm doing the very thing I hate, and that's being incredibly clerical. That as if the clergy are totally responsible for the church, and the lay people, who are the vast majority of the church, don't shape the church. And so I guess I want to say that we can't blame the clergy for the way the church is.
At least not entirely.
Well, I'm sorry. I think you've been unfair. On the other side of this, you know, it's extremely hard in a parish to preach about these things. You know, if you've been there and you've tried some of this, and to lift the people and ask them to sacrifice time. You know, the message I get is, the only time we'll give you is Sunday morning, and if you'll let us do this during education time, we'll form a committee for care for the earth, and that's what I'm facing when I go back. We won't give you any more time than that. And I'm saying, well, that's all I've got to work with when I go back. Now, these are people who deeply care. And because they're going to do it, I'm certainly not going to challenge that. We'll do it on Sunday morning.
Let me finish.
I'm certainly not going to challenge them and say, gee, I wish you'd give more than that. But did you see what I mean? There is that part
no.
of this too.
I think you're not hearing what's
being
said.
That.
Well, yeah, you're feeling it, and I have to say, I haven't stood up there in the pulpit very often, but and certainly not had the responsibility of trying to guide a church. But what I don't hear, and what I think many of the it ties in with what Carol was saying. It's not fair to say it's just the clergy, the clerical point of view. But what we as laity don't hear is that we are the church, and what we do 7 days of the week is the work of the church. And if there's a way in which we can begin to say it's not just an education program in the church, it's what you do with your whole life, you know, all of the days of the week out there. Are you being a part of it? You know, that's to me what seems important. That's the way to let me as a layperson feel empowered and a part of it all. Yeah.
I agree totally with that. The other thing I wanted to add, what I heard you say is, you know, the people who are in the top 90, the top 10% of SAT scores aren't going to seminary. I think the problem is when those folks do, that's a very specific kind of measure of intelligence, and I think it's to my deficit that I do well on those things, and that those are my skills. It would be much better if I was more right-brained, and I think we need more of those folks in the church, not good thinkers in a very kind of academic way.
Yes, maybe.
There's no reward for that. If you're a right-brained person, there's no reward for that.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear Al.
Al was going to tell us about
it. Well, I'm reflecting this book I'm reading, but this author says that there's no way to be liberated either personally or institutionally, unless you reject the capitalist system completely. That, I'm trying to now bring in a sociological dimension. I hear lots of cosmological, lots of what I'd call epistemological, how you know and all that. But his claim is that that the whole capitalist system is what produces the problem in our nature. And it produces our own personal problems. It's not just a matter of nature being liberated. We need to be liberated. The people are not happy. How come they have 50% of the year free? They have 50% of the year because they have a different economic system. They have a completely different system. Why are people not free to participate? because they start out in the morning at 6 o'clock and drive for an hour and a half, and then they work all day, and then they come back another hour and a half, and they're frazzled by the time they finish the highways, at least in around Chicago. And there's no way for there to be the kind of freedom. Then when you do get free, you're struggling to have some kind of an experience which gives you something that offsets this this professional, so-called professional joyride. I don't think professional life is such a joyride. I think at all levels, I don't know where there's really a satisfaction in professional life. There must be some places where there's considerable satisfaction, but certainly a lot of life up and down the line is not very satisfying to people.
I wanted to say I really appreciate that, and I hear that in our people, and I know that. I know that's why they don't have time. And there's some of those people that are even single parents. I don't even know how they survive in that sort of
thing. If you have really that, it's
survival to us.
So that, I was glad to hear Jerry talk about this little group, because there's a sense in which you got to withdraw from modern society in order to be human.
I'd like to know more about that group, because I would say that those 6 months that they spent partying is when they did their work as people.
Oh, yes.
Amen.
And that was responsible. Those 6 months were responsible for their life.
So we are the subject of a productive enterprise that alienates. Marx was right. We're alienated. But this author says the socialists are all alienated too. They haven't changed anything really significant about productivity. They've just changed somehow who owns the resources, and of course it leads to all kinds of violations. So that's not going to do it. They're still producing, and they're still using the resources, and they're still not having a human relationship to each other or to the earth. And it's unbelievable, because now what happens, of course, is these productive enterprises go into the third world and create the third world life. They create the third world life. McDonald's, for example, going into Russia or wherever they go, and Coca-Cola all over the world, they try to reproduce and introduce our value system. It's a value system, it's a social structure that destroys, in my judgment, I agree with this author, destroys nature. And what one needs is to find ways to protect a little bit from the worst effects of this system. But he's talking about you can't even become a part of the politics. There's no way to become a part of a political party anywhere. He's the Green Party he's talking about. He says, we can't be a part of any of the other parties. They're all sold out to the productive enterprise. And there's nothing that they will do. They will do some things, because they're forced now to do some things to be a little protective. But a little bit of protection is not going to deal with the fundamental issues which nature is now saying no to. What I see nature is saying no to is the whole capitalist Western industrial system and ethos. It's not just it's the whole value structure. That somehow, by having things and making things and controlling, Heidegger would say, making, shaping, controlling, it won't work. And nature is now saying it hasn't worked. And the question is whether you can manipulate and maneuver. And I think my first impulse was to think about what you can do to get our production so controlled that we don't have so many carbon emissions. But I see no way to get our carbon emissions down to 10% with our present productive enterprise. No way to get them down. So there's no way really to do anything significant except with an almost complete withdrawal from the system. Now, how do you withdraw? That's major. This person suggests.
Who is that person that you're speaking about?
It's Rudolf Barrow.
And what's the name of the book?
One of the lead. It's the development of the Green Party, but he's got several books, and he did his thesis on Holder. I mean, he's an unbelievably educated person. Refers to the Benedictines as probably having the model for us. They responded to the fall of the Roman Empire and preserved a lot of life and organized life. So we need something like the Benedictines today.
Elmer.
Further loony ideas. I worship at least the shrine of Lewis Thomas. I wonder if one of the, and I don't believe that nature is the way we are describing in this room. I think that's a belief system that I have to either grow into or help destroy. And I'm not too sure that nature is as absolutist as the left brain of the people who are analyzing. But the compromise may well be that the church ought to, that we ought to find a way to get the church to accept what? Tell me. Microbiology, whatever it may be, is a new revelation. That it is added. Old Testament or New Testament and microbiology, and these will be now a midpoint as a step towards something else.
Third Testament.
The Third Testament or something like that. Just make that announcement and, you know, let Lewis Thomas's words suddenly become canonical or something like that. But that would, that is reachable within something. I'd like to see a looming idea of compromise.
I just wanted really to ask, because I'm not sure any longer. I started out in science myself, so I feel very, very indebted to the scientific view. But are we still using the particle language, even? Isn't that going by the board
in well,
scientific thought?
We're using the duality of particle and waves because there are aspects of physical reality that really don't make sense as waves, and there are aspects of that don't make sense as particles. You really need both to understand it.
But also, the breaking down of
temporary particles.
Damage a holistic understanding of nature in some way or other? Is that a way to deal with nature?
That we haven't found the fundamental one?
Yeah.
Well, that's a continuing paradox, yes. The Greek idea that there was a fundamental particle, that they thought atoms were what we call atoms.
I'm thinking of the energy that the flowers are responsible for my life and have a part in that. And the whole holistic understanding. I mean, I still think it's a helpful methodology, but there's not a new methodology emerging as I'm reading the literature. Also in the language of the scientists of today, the Newtonian approach is beginning to be really questionable.
Well,
that's been questioned for decades.
Yeah.
I think we'd have to get down to talking more specific than we're going to be able to here, and in more technical detail to answer that. But there's a lot of criticism of the Newtonian way, and particularly the Cartesian way of looking at things. Yes.
Well, I just wanted to voice that.
Sure.
As an aside, because I do believe that, for example, our European counterparts in the theology do have a much broader education in some respects, although we've tried to have pre-theological training, try to have an artis generalis, as it used to be called, the general arts, that kind of a basic education that would enable us understand much more generally. I think theologians, in many respects, pastors need to be generalists in the sense that they at least are able to talk with you about your vocation, what you're doing.
Yes.
And so, which is a terrific challenge to be able to do that with the multiplicity of languages. And then the understanding of the pastoral role or in the congregation, as in the old theology of the laity now, that we really are the kitchen crew, if anything, where the congregation can be fed in some way, and maybe out of some of the expertise of having studied scripture and the tradition. I no longer talk just about scripture because I'm scared of being a book religion. Tradition, that's what you've handed down, much more broad thinking. But the kitchen crew, is really limited. Hopefully you get some food when you come to the gathered community, but then when you're the scattered community, when we are the scattered community, how are we being the church? That's what I hear you pleading for and crying out for. And I suppose we have to get that kitchen crew a little more on the ball, the pastors, the theologians who are supposed to provide some nourishment that enables the church to be the scattered community. That language.
Well, on that point, and kind of coming back and responding to a couple of things that Beth said earlier, I would like to say that I have had some pastors in the course of my life that were terrific. And I have to admit that some of what I say by way of criticism of the clergy has come out of being frustrated with some unsatisfactory pastors and being in effect driven out of one church. So in a sense I want to offer an apology for being maybe a little bit more tart-tongued or blunt than maybe I should be on this score. But the suggestion you're making, Carl, that a greater affirmation of and a greater recognition that the work of the church goes on 7 days a week and the people are the church and they're out there doing it wherever they are, that would be a very refreshing kind of perspective to hear more of from the pulpit than I have, I think, anywhere in the course of my life. I'd also like to speak to the point that Jane made about and several people made that maybe I'm not looking at death and versus celebration of life as I should. I think I'd want to stand by what I have said, with emphasis on the tense of the verbs that I used. I'd say that at present, I think human beings are terribly afraid of death, and that we're not doing very much by way of celebration of life. And that I think animals don't have the fear of death that we do, and that they do a great better job in many ways of celebration of life. And that looking to the future, I think you're absolutely right, that's what we have to learn to do more of. And I'd kind of like to close this session with reading you a poem that I rarely share with anybody, but has been extremely meaningful to me, and I think captures a lot of what I think of as the loony idea of what the future might be and how to achieve it. It's by Gary Snyder. It's called For the Children, and it in a way starts out with an acknowledgement of some of these statistics and graphs that I have used here, but goes on in a way to say many of the things that Jane's talked about. So let me just read this to you. I carry it around in my wallet all the time, so I just happen to have it here. It says, "The rising hills, the slopes of statistics lie before us." That's the reference to the kinds of things that I've been talking about. The steep climb of everything going up, up, as we all go down. In the next century, or the one beyond that, they say, our valleys and pastures, we can meet there in peace if we make it. To climb those coming crests, one word to you and to your children. Stay together, learn the flowers, go light. Seems to me that a lot of what we've been talking about is, in effect, staying together. It's learning to respect each other, to listen to each other. It's to carry out the agenda of peace that we have not done completely to date. It's to recognize the people of different color as really being our brothers. To learn the flowers, that seems to me to be a reference to what Jane talks about of in effect learning our place as human beings relating to other species, of really knowing what those flowers do in the world. And go light, you know, that's in part what Holden's about. It's living more simply. But beyond that, when you think of moving through time, traveling through time, and traveling lightly, I think it has to do with the kind of being at peace and being unafraid that is going to be necessary if we're going to be open mentally to seeing things the way that we need to see them anew and afresh. So I'll conclude here with a suggestion that one poem is got a lot of ideas in it that deserve further reflection.